So thanks everyone for coming. I'm very happy to be here because I don't know how many of you know this, but I used to be a postdoc here, right? And I actually used to organize these seminars back in the day, no? So it's very nice to have a chance, no, to come back, no, and see that everything is like either the same or like just a bit different. No? And yeah, so actually after I moved away from here, I went to do another postdoc at the MPQ, which is the Max Planck Institute for Quantum Optics, which is actually where this work took place. And this was in collaboration with my colleague there, who was another postdoc in the group of Ignacio Chirac, Dominic Wild. Yeah, but actually since then, in January, basically, I moved to my new position back in Spain, where I'm from, to this Institute of Theoretical Physics. And since probably not many of you know about this, I just wanted to tell you where I'm based now, which is basically in the capital of Spain, no, in Madrid. So it's basically an Institute of Theoretical Physics, which is in a campus in the north of the city. And actually, it's a bit like perimeter in the sense that most of the people there are actually doing things like cosmology, string theory, you know, and stuff like this. But there's like a growing quantum effort there. No? So we're currently trying to push. And in case people are interested, because I was talking to Jinchen about this, this is where the Real Madrid Stadium is. No? just for reference. yep. Okay. So now I just start with the presentation. So I'm gonna be talking about a topic that probably for most of you is like, you know, the kind of problem you deal with in your daily lives in some version, no? which is basically the problem of studying quantum many-body systems, right? But in a bit of a general sense, right? So I'm going to be focusing on systems which, okay, actually I say here on the lattice, but actually what I'm going to say doesn't exactly necessarily narrow down to lattices. But what I'm going to be talking about is about general Hamiltonians, which are local, no? In the sense that every single term in the Hamiltonian couples only a few other, let's say, qubits or a few other particles, right? And of course, this type of model describes a lot of interesting things in nature, right? So the question we want to know, like, and we're trying to very hard to understand better, is, you know, when and how can we compute physically relevant phenomena and, you know, features, quantities that have to do with these models, you know, for instance, in 2D models and things like this. No? And this is, of course, a very important problem for very many branches of physics, but as you all know, it's very difficult, right? For like quite fundamental reasons, right? And I guess the most naive reason why it's difficult is that, of course, this type of system, when we want to describe it mathematically, you know, we want to describe we need to describe a Hilbert space of dimension that is exponential in the system's size, right? So like direct computational approaches are going to fail at some point, right? So of course there are solutions to this, no? And the solutions in the end should probably usually go along the lines of like trying to understand a bit better the physics and just finding workarounds, no? to this like fact of having to deal with exponential Hilbert space, right? Okay, so typically what states do we care about for physics, right? So I would say there's like three of them, no? Which are ground states, thermal states, and dynamics, no? And in this talk I'm going to be focusing on dynamics. But actually, with tools that are kind of connected to the way people also study, to the way people study the Gibbs states, no? Because of course, they're kind of fairly similar objects here, no? Exponentials of Hamiltonians, right? So how can we study these things? No, I mean, one way of doing this is quantum simulation, no? Which is kind of up and coming, right? And we're hoping to be able to study a lot of models by simulating them in like cold atoms and things like this, no? But I think another very, very valuable way, which is the one I'm going to be focusing on here, right, is trying to find, at least for a subset of problems, efficient classical ways of approximating different properties, these models, right? And these efficient ways have to allow us to extract physical information, right, in a way that we know how to do. And also, ideally, we would like to have some sort of physical understanding of why these methods work, no? These classical methods for certain kinds of problems, right? So I'm going to be focusing on one method that basically answers this question, or kind of goes along the lines of this point, no? Which is cluster expansion, okay? So the whole talk is going to be about this thing, which are called cluster expansions, which I don't know how many of you have heard of, but I'm going to assume that none of you, let's say, or very, very few of you. No? So what is the intuition here? So of course, the intuition is that we're going to look at unitaries, right, which are basically the exponential of a Hamiltonian for some times, right? And of course, it's a unitary that lives in this exponentially big Hilbert space, right? But this unitary is very particular, right? Because it's an exponential of H, which is a local operator, right? So, and a local operator is somehow like not very, it's a very special operator within Hilbert space, no? It's like much more simple than kind of the arbitrary operator you can draw like randomly from the Hilbert space, let's say, no? So the hope that we have and the kind of fact that we would like to exploit here is that somehow this type of operator is going to inherit some of the simplicity of the Hamiltonian. No? So you're taking the exponential, and somehow the exponential is going to inherit some of that implicitly, let's say. No? And the easiest way to see this, which is basically what I'm going to be doing here, is just by taking the Taylor expansion for short times. No? So of course the leading order is h, no? And then of course the more times you take, the more somehow this thing complicates, right? But you know, you hope that you know this kind of resembles its Taylor expansion, and also the Taylor expansion somehow is like simpler than a general operator, right? So that's more or less the type of idea we want to exploit here. Okay, any questions so far? Okay, so actually first I just want to kind of give a summary of the results, and I will go to somehow the idea behind them, right? So we have two main results here, which are basically classical algorithms for approximating two different quantities, okay? So one of them is the Heisenberg evolution, okay? So I have an observable which lives like in some small region of the lattice, right? And I can evolve it in time with the usual Heisenberg evolution. And then I compute the expectation value with some state that actually, here it has to be a product state, actually, this state. So a product between all the qubits. That's important for the algorithm, actually. So what we have is somehow some algorithm that outputs some function f of t that depends on time, and that we guaranteed that it approximates this function to error epsilon, right? And this algorithm has a runtime which is upper bounded by this thing, which is actually, so it's a function of epsilon and of t, right? Which are the relevant parameters, right? And of course, there's more parameters that have to do with the Hamiltonian, but these are the t and epsilon, the ones that are maybe that matter the most here. And you see that actually it depends on like 1 over epsilon here, but also it's doubly exponential in time. And I will tell you later why we get this and why I think this result, you know, it's a very bad dependence with time, with the runtime, but I will tell you why we think it's still interesting, okay? And then the other result is about this other quantity, which is called the Losmideko. Sometimes the Losmideko is defined a bit different, but the way we define it is basically as somehow like a bit of an unlocal quantity, no? Where we have a state that again has to be a product state. That's important. And then we evolve it in time and we look at the fidelity of the evolved state with the initial state. Okay? And then we take the logarithm, right? sorry, I have a bit of a cough. So also we have an algorithm which outputs some function of t, which we know also approximates well this quantity, no? And this actually, the runtime of this is polynomial, both in n and epsilon to the minus one. However, actually this only works for like very short times. So this works for like arbitrary long times, even if it grows very badly, but this only works somehow in like a very short interval of time. And this is like, you cannot do better than this actually. Okay, so this is just a teaser, and I will move now to the ideas in a bit more detail. Okay. So in this, basically, I'm telling you that we have algorithms that output these functions, right? So what are these functions? They're basically the Taylor expansion of a. So this is the Taylor expansion of this. This is the Taylor expansion of this to some order. That's it. And why does the algorithm work? It's actually very simple. So the idea is that we want to prove really that the functions we're dealing with, so the Heisenberg evolution, the Losmideko, they're somehow analytic, meaning that the Taylor expansion converges well, right? So the more orders you take, the closer you are to your original function, right? The better you have the approximation, right? In particular, exponentially well, right? So this is what happens with analytic functions, no? That they resemble the Taylor expansions exponentially well, okay? In the order of the Taylor expansion. Okay, so there's a few ingredients that we need to prove in order to have like a classical algorithm. The first one is this, to prove convergence of the Taylor series. The second one is to estimate the cost of calculating the Taylor coefficients, right? Because we want to output the Taylor series, right? So we want to know how, so if this is the Taylor series, we want to know how to compute these numbers, how long does it take as a function of m, the order of the expansion. And then basically with this, we have it, you know, because we know that we can compute these numbers and that they approximate our function, right? So then we just kind of calculate this whole thing and then we're done, basically. That's the idea behind the algorithms. So very simple. Okay, so now I'm going to be starting talking about the actual method, the cluster expansion, a bit more in detail. And actually, I'm going to move away from dynamics because I want to write things actually in terms of what typically, the kind of thing people typically study with this method, which are actually free energies, meaning the logarithm of the partition function, okay, of your Hamiltonian. So basically what this method gives you is somehow a way of explicitly computing or kind of understanding what is the Taylor expansion of this function, okay? So what's the idea here? So we have these moments, this k sub m, which are the ones we want to understand and we want to compute, no? And we want to understand also how they grow, basically, for the convergence of the Taylor series, right? And you know, notice that for this, we have to do two things. So it's somehow like a nested Taylor series, no? Where first we have this thing, and then we have the logarithm, right? So you have to think that first we take the Taylor expansion of this, of the exponential, and then the one of the logarithm, no? Which we know what it is, no? The Taylor expansion of the logarithm. Maybe you can more or less see that the idea is that in the end, what this expansion looks like is basically some sum of products of expectation values of Hamiltonian terms, okay? Where, I'm just writing this without really telling you what is the structure behind here, because it's a bit convoluted. But the idea is this, no? That basically, first we take the trace, we expand the exponential, and that gives us, you know, the trace of like things of this form, right? Because where these are like products of local terms, right? Because for instance, in H square, you will have like the product of every single term with every single local term with every other, right? So you have these type of traces here. And then you expand the logarithm. So because you expand the logarithm, you get products of these traces. Okay. So this is the kind of thing we want to. This is the kind of thing we have, no? So what we want to understand is basically what is the structure, no? What is the structure of this object, right? So what are the products of traces that we have, no? And what is the coefficient in front of this, right? So that's the idea. Is this more or less clear? Okay. So the way to actually write this is in terms of what is called clusters, okay? So let me just say that, okay, so now I'm just redefining my local Hamiltonian to be this, where X is just individual interaction terms, and I just say that their norm is smaller than one, like a usual assumption. Okay, and then I define a cluster. So a cluster is basically a multiset of Hamiltonian terms. So the idea here is that I'm gonna pick some set. So every single cluster is the following, no? I pick a set of Hamiltonian terms. So just imagine here, for instance, that the Hamiltonian is like free local. So the particles interact like in this way, between groups of three. So I will have this term here, which will be one of these, and basically all of them, right? So I can just define a cluster in terms of a set of D of this, where also I can have the same term repeated, right? So this is the idea, no? So here, for instance, I have H1, whatever this is, twice, and then I have another one, and then a couple of HL, no? So like this is basically a cluster, no? It's just a list of these terms, no? And a set of clusters is a list of lists, no? Which of course can grow quite, it's very large, this list, no? And the idea is that these terms, so to order M, to order M in this expansion, I have each of the terms in this expansion is gonna correspond to a cluster of size M, okay? And just in the same way that you see, here, you know, this corresponds to clusters of size 1, size 2, and so on. So now I want to define different types of clusters because something is going to happen. So this logarithm here, this logarithm here actually that's something pretty interesting. And to explain this, I have to explain different types of clusters. You can forget about this one for now, actually. But the types of clusters I want to talk about are connected and disconnected, okay? Which are really just, I mean, it's very intuitive, no? It's basically, connected clusters are the ones for which, like, somehow the underlying graph is connected, right? So there's always somehow a path from one to the other, no? And here I'm putting, like, some lines that are like, thicker because I'm representing that, for instance, this term appears a few more times, no? Like, so there's multiplicities, right? And then a disconnected cluster is one where actually I can divide the cluster into two parts that are disconnected, right? At least two parts, no? Could be more than this, right? And then also I can define, so if I define a particular local observable, I can also define a cluster that is connected to that particular observable, right? Is this clear? I mean, this is just really looking at graphs and whether they're connected or not. And they're not really graphs because you can also have multiplicities, right? So you have to take into account that the edges may have more weight, right? and you have to count the weight when you count the order of the cluster, right? So M is somehow the number of Hamiltonian terms, no? They can be repeated. Okay, so the key thing that happens when you take the logarithm actually is that when you take here in these numbers, in these Taylor coefficients, you can write this as a sum of clusters of size M, where M is the Taylor order, no? But notice that actually it's not all clusters that contribute to this. What happens, and this is a bit, I mean, I don't know if I can, I might be able to prove this, but it takes a couple of minutes, it's not super hard, is that the clusters that contribute to the to the coefficients of the logarithm are all connected. So it's only these ones. Yeah, it's only these ones, right? Not these ones. This is a bit slow. Not this one, it's only these ones. So this actually reduces the number of clusters I have to consider in expansion by a lot, in a way that actually makes the problem tractable. This is really the key of what's going on. And then also we can understand what is the coefficient in terms of, so basically every cluster is gonna have, is gonna correspond to some sort of combinations of products of traces. And we also want to know what is the coefficient in front of that. And this is given by a function, which people understand. This is called the Russell function, okay? And the simplest example of this expansion is the second order, actually, where you see the when you expand this to second order, basically the contributions you have are the connected correlation functions of Hamiltonian terms, which are also connected, right? So for instance, you will have the connected correlation function of like this edge with this edge, for instance. So the second order is this, no? And the Russell function is somehow the function that tells you that the coefficient here is a 1 and the coefficient here minus 1. And then it somehow generalizes this to higher orders, right? And there's some, I mean, there's some like nice combinatorial understanding of how this works, actually. Okay, so now basically what happens is that we've reduced the problem of trying to like understand this function, right? Because now what we need to do, we need to count, to be able to count how many clusters, how many connected clusters are there, because they're the ones that are going to contribute to the Taylor terms. And also, actually, how each cluster somehow contributes to the expansion, right? So we want to know how many terms are here in the sum, and then what is this thing, right? And this is, I mean, and this, we know what it is, basically. We have some ways of dealing with that, right? Which, I mean, probably is too much detail for this talk, but I can talk more about it later. Okay, but now I can actually move on to the kind of result we want to get out of this, right? So first, we want to prove the first ingredient of our algorithm, which is that this expansion converges. Okay, so this is just a few ingredients that I can tell you. And actually, there's a couple of papers where they somehow deal with this cluster expansion. I mean, there's way more from like the mathematical physics literature, but these are two that are maybe more well known to this audience. And actually, they show. So I put an asterisk because actually they kind of show that they prove this convergence, but there was a little mistake in these papers that we were able to fix in particular. Here, but anyway, so the idea here is that we need a few statements, right? First, we need to know that there are exponentially many connected clusters, right? So, the number of connected clusters of size m is the size of a lattice n times, which is because you have to move around the lattice to span all the connected clusters, right? But also, the number of clusters that somehow are connected to a particular site is exponential in the size of the cluster, right? So the number of combinations in which you can grow this type of cluster is exponential in the number of terms, let's say. And also, so this is somehow the number of terms in the sum that defines these coefficients, right? And also, we want to bound the contribution of each cluster, okay? And we can bound this by a number which is basically a factorial here, and this factorial is going to cancel the factorial in the Taylor series times some constant to the power of m. And actually, I should have written down what this is, but maybe I can write down these constants now because they're not actually so difficult. So these clusters are defined in terms of like this local Hamiltonian, right? And there's a parameter that defines the geometry of the Hamiltonian, which I call this delta. And this delta is somehow the maximum, so for a given site. For a given Hamiltonian term is the number of other Hamiltonian terms that somehow overlap with that term, right? So here in a square lattice, it will be 6, right? I think, yeah, 6. So then actually C1 is just is E times this number, and C2 is 2E, this number plus 1. Okay, so then with these two things, basically we have an upper bound on the Taylor term. No, it's just by multiplying these two things, right? And then if you multiply C1 and C2, you get a constant, which is an order one constant, which is basically the product of these two. And this we're going to call a 1 over beta star, which is somehow like a threshold temperature, right? It's the product of these two. And this is this sets somehow the radius of convergence of this expansion, right? And then within this range of temperatures, no, of like high temperatures, we know that the Taylor expansion converges. and converges exponentially well. And this is just the way you show this from here is just by like summing this as a geometric sum, basically. It's very simple. So this somehow you can do from first principles, but of course this type of analysis is, I mean, it's something people have been doing in statistical physics for like a very long time, right? It's just that I think, for instance, these two papers, I don't know if they didn't know about it or they just kind of decided to like do it by themselves again, no? But there are actually very nice methods to study the convergence of this type of expansion. And in particular, there's a paper which is very famous in this field, which is this Kotecian Price paper, which actually gives you like a very somehow general result about how to prove when this type of expansion converges, right? And it's actually a bit more general than just for partition functions, right? So this framework is actually quite flexible. No? The framework is actually called polymer models. I don't know exactly why it's called polymer models, but there's a lot of literature on like very kind of hardcore mathematical physics, right? On this. And of course, this type of idea is related to like the study of phase diagrams, right? Of local models, you know, of IC model and things like this. No? Because of course, the way when this expansion converges, then this function is analytic. So you're away from a phase transition. Right? So that's typically how you prove that you're away from phase transitions, right? From thermal phase transitions, no? Like in two dimensions, in the IC model, and things like this. No? Any questions so far? Get some water. Okay, so now the next step is we've proven convergence, so now we want to prove something about computation, right? Yep.
Actually, a question. Can different types of phase transitions, like first order, second order, have different behavior in terms of divergence?
Okay. This I don't know. I don't know if this tells you that because this really tells you when there's not a phase transition, right? So I don't know if you can use it for that. Right, it somehow narrows down the, tells you where in the phase diagram of like, for instance, of temperatures or other parameters that you expand around when you don't have a phase transition, right? But you never actually reach the phase transition point, as far as I understand.
A question about the convergence formula in the previous slide. So it seems it only converges for high temperature.
Mm-hmm.
The Taylor series converges exponentially.
Yeah.
That bound. And it seems it only works for high temperature.
No, I guess what I'm explaining here is like the high temperature expansion, right? But the idea is that depending on your Hamiltonian, you can expand around other parameters, right? So you can expand, for instance, around magnetic fields and things like this. And then you will get a similar result also. It's just that the high temperature is the one I'm going to be using, let's say, no? But you can expand around different things, no? And sometimes people, yeah, there's, actually in this book is very nice. It has also some proofs about how to expand around in terms of the magnetic field for like some ground state. I never studied like a lot of statistical physics in my studies, no? But there's this like, what's it called? This thing that Perls did. Anyway, so there's definitely a lot of different expansions you can do, no? But they actually all fall within the same sort of set of ideas, no? How to study these expansions in terms of clusters and so on. And these polymer models basically can encompass all this.
If you do the high temperature expansion, how does the beta star depend on the lattice dimension?
Yeah, so it depends, not in the dimension exactly, but on the number of terms. So if you have a particular Hamiltonian term, you have to look at, well, there's probably different bounds you can have, but the one I know is the one where you consider how many Hamiltonian terms touch another one. So of course, the higher the dimension, the higher that's going to be, right? So, and this is this number, right?
Okay.
So then beta star is inverse of,
I see.
Of this number squared, right?
I see.
But actually, but this is the only constraint. So actually, this also works for like expander graphs and things like this.
Okay.
So you don't need lattice exactly, no? You just need this. Like locality, let's say.
Yeah, a follow-up question of Shenqi's. So suppose a model has multiple finite temperature phase transitions.
Uh-huh.
Which regimes does this apply? Only the highest regime or all the regimes?
So this thing I'm saying, this is for high temperatures, and this somehow, I think you can basically study this expansion for all Hamiltonians. So of course you know that for high enough temperatures, there are no phase transitions, no? And this expansion is how you prove it. And then there will be other models with particular features for which you can do more expansions, right, around different parameters. Does that answer your So the high temperature expansion, the way I see it is that somehow it applies to all models, because here I'm not talking about a specific model. There are other types of expansions that help you narrow down the phase diagram that will apply to specific models.
I mean, does this, suppose a model has multiple finite temperature phase transitions,
mm-hmm.
does this particular method apply to the intermediate temperature?
I guess you'll have to do a different kind of expansion. And maybe you can, maybe you don't, you don't know how to do it, I don't know. I mean, ideally you will be able to do it, right? Because of course, if you're away from phase transitions, this thing should hold, no? Or well, maybe with a different parameter here in the convergence, no? But something like this should hold because your function is analytic, right? So, I guess in theory, you're able to do it. In practice, I don't know if you're ever always able to write the actual expansion. I don't know too much about actual specific models. So just to talk about the next step a bit of the algorithm, which has to do with how do we compute these Taylor terms, right? And the idea is that we have to compute each contribution from every cluster. And for this, we need to compute this thing, this Ursell function that I was talking about, right? And there's a nice result by some computer scientists. Sorry, this T is the runtime. It's the runtime of an algorithm. So this Ursell function, you can compute it in time that is exponential in the size of the cluster. Okay. And then you can also count the number of clusters, right? And this is the other thing you need to do. No? So we said before that there's like exponentially many clusters, but you're also able to, you know, but doesn't the number is not the same as being able to count them, right? But actually, it turns out that you're also able to count them in a time that is exponential in the system size, right? It's just that the constant here is, I think, it's not as natural as this one. Or I guess I haven't seen exact expressions, right? So that's why I write it like this, with this notation. So it takes exponential time in the size of the cluster, right? So that means that basically to compute a particular Taylor term, you have to somehow merge these two things together. So to calculate the nth term, it's basically the product of these two, right? So it's a system size times something exponential in the size of the cluster, right? And this works, of course, for small temperatures, right? There's a big end missing here. No? So the k sub m, the runtime it takes to calculate it, is n times exponential in m. So then, if I want to have an epsilon approximation with this exponentially good convergence, the Taylor order I have to reach is logarithmic in n over epsilon. Okay. So I can put this big M here, and the cost is basically the exponential of a logarithm of n over epsilon. And this means that the runtime is polynomial in n over epsilon. Okay. This is the runtime of the algorithm. And this is how you get the polynomial algorithm in n and 1 over epsilon. So that's the idea. Is this clear? Of course, this only works for short temperatures because otherwise we're not guaranteed. For high temperatures because otherwise we don't know whether it converges or not, right? So we don't know whether this works. So this has appeared in some other results about in quantum information, and I guess I just want to briefly mention them. One of the main things is to approximate partition functions. So this is also useful for like things like concentration bounds of Gibbs states, so to know, for instance, when like microscopic properties are somehow picked around the average. And actually, recently, there's this nice paper that I've mentioned also before, which is about somehow like doing efficient tomography for Gibbs states, right? Another thing I want to mention, and this is something that I actually got from one of Davis' papers, is that this type of method of cluster expansions is related to some other methods that people use in computer science. So there's this thing called Barvinox interpolation method and also the Lobach local lemma and so on. This I know from your paper. That seems to be related to this type of method. No? So it seems to me that computer scientists are also kind of rediscovering this method for like other, from a different angle, no? From a slightly different angle.
Can I ask in that paper, the Lobach local lemma is used to get the bound on the zero free radius.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you were to use your technique instead,
mm-hmm.
you would get the same result?
I think so. Something analogous at least, no? Some sort of convergence of this logarithm of the amplitude. Because you expand around this parameter, no? And then you look at the... Yeah, because you have a loaded circuit, no? So you look at
the same technique, except this Lobach local lemma, you know, all it also relies on, you know, the number of things that you
mm-hmm.
argue with.
And this, so there's this in these papers by Barminong, no, there's this way of computing this polynomial and so on, with this inclusion exclusion principle, no, this type of thing.
Yeah, but we use a cluster expansion to get it.
Oh, okay, it's basically that. Okay, so it was really
We don't call it that. But.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So it's but it's the same set of ideas, I guess. No, maybe slightly differently packaged. And yeah, I guess also I want to say that this framework is, I find it quite flexible, no? So maybe this other stuff you can do with it. So I think it's interesting. Actually, maybe now I just want to move on to our results, no? what we're thinking about in this context, no? And the first is just like a very simple observation, actually, which is that, basically we look at the Losmi dichotomy, right? And of course, you can notice this quantity is very similar to this quantity, no? And the difference is that you have the complex number there, you have the I. This difference doesn't matter, actually. And then we also have, instead of a trace, we have an expectation value. But what we realized basically is that there was this very important fact, no, which is that when you do the cluster expansion of this, only the connected clusters contribute, right? And what we realized basically is that if you take your state to be a product state, then the same principle applies also. So you can also understand this quantity in terms of connected clusters. And this really relies on the fact that your state is product, no? In the same sense that, of course, there you're taking a trace and the identity is a product state. So it's just like a small generalization of this, right? So you can just take the same methods, right? The same results you use to calculate the partition function, you can apply it to this. And what you get is that, first, for like short times, where T star is basically now related to this temperature, is basically the same thing. Your Taylor expansion converges, and you can compute it up to order m, which is logarithm of n over epsilon. And with this, you have an algorithm with runtime polynomial in n over n and epsilon to the minus one, no? For like short times, basically. That's it. Okay. And actually for this, somehow it's, we know that somehow you cannot really improve this in general, right? And there's, in this case, actually it's a bit simpler to see than in the case of partition functions, no? Because now, so if you look at this function, for instance, no, in the complex plane, no, where T is, T can be an arbitrary complex number, no? Basically, what we prove with this is that there's a finite radius of convergence, right? And along the imaginary axis, you're going to find the thermal phase transitions, and along the real axis, you're going to find this thing which are called the dynamical phase transitions, which are basically non-analyticities of this function, right? And there's a very simple way to see why, in general, you're not going to be able to go beyond this radius. Yeah.
If some model just doesn't have any thermal phase transition, does it just apply to very low temperatures?
I don't think so. I think they can be a bit different. I don't think there's like a one-to-one mapping. I think people study this in like the physics literature, but I don't know exactly what's the status. But I think they're not exactly the same thing. You can have one or not the other, but you can have both. So,
is it also an issue that you need higher and higher order derivatives when T is larger? And I mean, mm-hmm. like the order of the Taylor expansion that you need to go to depends on T, right?
Well, I guess here it depends on T, but actually you're limited to like a particular radius, so the order is...
No, but like in our paper we showed that for random circuits, mm-hmm. or random, how random unitaries? Well, some random model of circuits, mm-hmm. The radius goes to one, you know, that the radius becomes large.
Ah, oh, convergence, okay.
The problem there is that you cannot compute the derivatives anymore. So I wonder if you have a similar thing, like if you consider random.
And why cannot you compute the derivatives?
Well, okay, so.
If you compute the derivatives like around the origin.
You're talking about like a hard random unitary. Uh-huh. And so the, you know, computing the local expected values is not easy.
I see.
My recollection.
Okay, I guess I don't know exactly. Because you have to compute the derivatives at like, well, t equals zero, no? With the equivalent of t equals zero, no? Or maybe some other point.
I guess, maybe we should discuss it later in here, but I wonder what happens when h is random because.
Okay, yeah, it's interesting, yeah. So let me just remark actually for this case, there's a very simple non-analyticity, no? Which is when the state becomes orthogonal to itself, no? So you can just imagine, for instance, that your model is not actually an interacting Hamiltonian, no? It's just single spins rotating. And the single spins are going to become orthogonal to themselves at some point. and at that point, this number is going to be zero. And of course, the logarithm is non-analytic at zero, right? And this type of thing for interactive models, at least, this is called these dynamical phase transitions, which we know happen actually even in one dimension. So actually, this is one difference actually between dynamical and thermal phase transitions, which is that dynamicals can happen in one dimension also. And actually, another angle, which is kind of more from the computer science side, is that people have studied this type of quantity a bit more. For some sort of generalized Ising model, and they find that actually computing this quantity, 2 over epsilon, for like some number that is like order one, but of course away from this type of radius, is actually sharply hard. So very, very hard, computationally very, very hard.
I think previously you answered a different question. I was asking, suppose a model has no phase transition.
Uh-huh.
Does this method just apply for a very large time scale?
Ah, okay. So I guess it should, but I don't know if you always know how to prove that, right? Of course, you can start with the assumption like, oh, let's assume that my model does not have a phase transition. And then just from the fact that your function is analytic, you're able to somehow argue that that something like this should hold, right? But maybe you can actually show it from first principles, right? It depends on your starting point. No? Do you want to start with like the model itself and just from first principles show that there are no phase transitions, or you assume that there are, or you start assuming that there are no phase transitions? So yeah, basically that's the point. No? You cannot, for sure we can show this, but it's not clear that you can always show, you can somehow map the whole phase diagram with this. No? Maybe it's not always possible to do this. Yeah, and it might depend on your model and so on, how difficult it is.
I actually don't know too many examples which do have dynamical phase transition.
You don't, no? Okay, yeah, I don't know the literature very well, so I'll be happy to discuss it. I know people have shown this for like some solvable models in one dimension. That's why I know they exist in one dimension, but I guess people make analogies with the thermal phase transitions, no, and so on, but I don't know. I follow this literature a little bit, but not too much, so I cannot say too much about this. Mm-hmm. Okay, so just to highlight some physical consequences of this result, no? Because we basically proved the non-analyticity of this, right? So actually there's a couple of consequences of this which are along the lines of what I was saying. First is that actually we give a bound on how long this star is basically a bound on how long it takes for the initial state to become orthogonal to itself when you evolve it in time, no? And this fact actually is usually called this thing called the quantum speed limit, which seems to be quite well studied. So there are some results that basically hold for general models. I don't know if you know this type of result. But basically what we show is that this time of the quantum speed limit, how long it takes to become orthogonal to itself, is bounded by some quantity that is order one. And whereas these general results actually basically they depend on the energy, yeah, on the average energy and on the energy variance, no? So actually they decay with system size. So it's like an improvement for local models, no, of this type of result. I guess if you've never heard of this, then maybe this is not so impressive. And the other thing is related to dynamical phase transitions, no? Because with this result basically tells you that they can only happen after some time. In the same way that there are no high temperature phase transitions. No? So the analog of this fact, right? And actually something I could mention this a bit more, but maybe it's not so important, is that we can also show from this type of result, we can also show concentration bounds for states that have evolved for like a short time. So basically, if you compute the expectation value of or if you measure a local observable in a state that has evolved for short times, then this concentration bound tells you that these properties are somehow concentrated around the average. So if you heard of this Chernoff bound basically follows from this result of showing that this function is analytic for short times.
So actually, I have a very naive question. So
yeah.
Why is this actually order one? Because in a qubit system, and if I rotate everything individually, it will quickly become orthogonal, right?
Yeah, with the non-interacting qubits.
Yeah,
yeah, but this, that time is going to be order one, right? Because it's going to be the energy gap of the qubit, right?
So why, in that case, I don't need order one time. It's much shorter. Right?
No, it's order one still.
Why? Right? Because each qubit becomes slightly known.
You have to go from here to like here?
Yeah, if I multiply all of these n terms, then there is an n enhancement, right?
So it's exponentially. So this number is exponentially small. Oh, it's not zero.
So, wait.
So, yeah, so you have all these qubits that are rotating independently, right?
Yeah.
And of course, when the overlap is not one,
this
number is going to be exponentially small, but it's not going to be zero. It's only going to be zero when the qubits rotate to the orthogonal state.
Uh-huh.
And that happens like for the time that it takes for the rotation, no, in the block sphere. So that takes order one, no, because that's basically the energy gap of the qubit.
Yeah, because I'm modifying it, so like even if it's still overlap is nearly one, if I multiply all of them, then is it like?
Well, if you multiply all of them, if they all have the same gap, if you multiply all of them, this thing is going to be exponentially small in the number of qubits, but it's not going to be zero. It's only going to be zero when.
What is T-star? T-star is the time for that to
for to become orthogonal. Yeah. I mean, there's no contradiction here. It's just for like a one local model, this star is basically going to be how long it takes for a qubit to like go from one to zero, for instance. Yeah, and this will be that T-star here. Yeah. Okay, so now actually I want to move to the second result here, which is about the different quantity, right? But we can also study it with this method. No, this quantity is the Heisenberg evolution. So just basically, you know, we take an observable A, which is going to leave. actually, we assume. I mean, this is not essential. We assume that it's something like a Hamiltonian term, no, where something that lives maybe, for instance, in an edge, no, but also be a bit bigger. So we want to look at this, no? And of course, we again want to take the Taylor expansion of this quantity. And here, the Taylor expansion is actually a bit simpler to understand, right? Because it's basically the nested commutators, right, of a Hamiltonian with the observable, right? So now, if you expand each of these Hamiltonians in terms of the sum of local terms, what you get is that this is going to be a sum over different commutators of groups of Hamiltonian terms, right? And of course, you can see that from the fact that these are commutators, the only terms that are going to contribute to this sum are connected. Because if they're not connected, the commutator is going to be zero at some point, right? Because I'm going to be commuting something that lives here with something that lives here, right? So that's going to be zero. So the only terms that contribute here have to do with connected clusters, right? There's going to be a lot of connected clusters that maybe have also zero contribution. But we don't care about this, no? We just want to first narrow it down to the sum to connected clusters, right? So we just have to look at this, again, these groups of connected clusters. And here, connected means actually connected to A, right? Because the first commutator is with A. So of course, A has to be connected to these Hamiltonian terms for this thing to be non-zero, right? And one nice thing about this function that is different from the previous one is that actually this function is analytic for all times. So this always converges. The Taylor expansion always converges, no? Because this quantity is bounded. You know, before we were looking at this logarithm, no? And the logarithm, you know, it can be like the logarithm of zero, which is like non-analytic, no? And so on. But here, this function is much nicer. It's always analytic. So that's going to make a difference, actually. Okay, so now we want to look at the classical simulation, no? So the same result as before, no? So we want to look at this sum, and basically we want to look at each term in this sum, how many terms are there, and how much does it contribute, right? So the number of terms is, again, the number of connected clusters connected to A. So again, this C1 is going to appear, which is this number here. And now, before I told you that we have to like analyze this like complicated Russell function, no? And there's this like combinatorial understanding of like this of how to prove a bound on the contribution of each cluster. Here is much simpler, because here we just need to upper bound the norm of this commutator. And the norm of this commutator is upper bounded by 2 to the m. And the factorial basically comes from like the permutation of all the terms, no? Because here you have all the combinations of all the Hamiltonian terms, no? But the point is that each commutator, the norm of each commutator is exponential. Basically, if you expand this out, the number of terms you have in this nested commutator is 2 to the m. And because we assume that the norm of each Hamiltonian is upper bounded by 1, then this bound follows, no? On the contribution from each cluster. So from this, automatically, we again get that we can prove a finite radius of convergence for short times. Okay? And this radius of convergence now is a bit different, no? Because actually I write this T star now, but this T star is not the product of this and this. It's the product of this and 2, basically, and 2. And we know we have this convergence for this small radius, right? This is all fine. And also we have some understanding of how to compute this Taylor expansion, no? Because we know that there's an algorithm that lists all the clusters, right? And also once we list all the clusters, we have to compute the contribution of each cluster. But we know what this is. This is like a nested commutator. And of course, this nested commutator lives in a Hilbert space that is that has m sites at most, no? So if you want to compute this thing, it's going to take you time that is exponential in the size of the cluster, no? Which is the e to the m of the previous algorithm. But here there's a bit of a twist, actually, which is what I said basically, you know, that the function now is this function is different to the other one, no? Because it's analytic for all times. No? Here, I've just shown you that it's analytic for like short times. But this is clearly very suboptimal, no? Because the function is actually analytic for all times, no? And of course, the easiest way to see this is that this number is bounded by the norm of A, no? Which is like a small number. So actually, then you can do something else, no? To prove convergence for like all times, basically, which is to use analytic continuation. And here we use some ideas from this book of Parvinok and also from a paper by Aram Harrow and his former students. And then what happens basically is that we can prove that the Taylor expansion of this function converges beyond the circle that we prove here. Because this is for a circle, no? But we can prove that it converges for actually a whole strip around the origin. No? And actually, there are examples that show that here you can have phase transitions. No? So this is real time. So on this axis, we know that this is analytic. And actually, we also know that it's analytic for like basically a strip. No, this is a bit more non-trivial, but this the fact that it's analytic here is easy to see. No, just kind of from this. So now we can basically prove a result like this convergence, but for all times actually. You know? And the idea to show this is this analytic continuation. And actually, one way of doing this, there's more than one actually, but I think the easiest one to explain is with this method that is called the chain of disks. No, we just first study these disks, and this is the one from the previous slide. And now you want to show how the Taylor expansion converges in the next disk. And basically what you do is you compute the Taylor expansion at this point using the coefficients from the previous one, right? So you somehow go disk by disk, no? And at some point you're able to compute how the Taylor expansion converges, for instance, at any point around here, no? But you have to somehow nest all these disks. And because of this construction, you have like some overhead on the number of Taylor coefficients that you have to consider, right? So the convergence of the Taylor expansion is much worse than the one that you just get for this radius, no? Because somehow you have to first like use this convergence here, then here, then here, and here, and at every single step you somehow lose a bit of, well, the error basically increases, right? So you have to consider more and more terms, no? And with this we get a result, which is that, you know, the series converges for all times, but actually converges a bit badly, no? So instead of the previous one, no, we had this convergence, which is something like t over t star to the power of m. Here we have this other thing, which is a bit different, which is that somehow this converges for all times, but somehow the constant here is exponentially close to one for like very long times, right? But still, you can use this result to just construct the algorithm, no? Because what you do is you say, okay, so now I'm going to compute the Taylor expansion up to order big M. And the big M is going to be, yeah, some choice that you make. So before we were choosing, something like log of n over epsilon. And now we have to somehow make up for the fact, so we want this number to be epsilon small. So we somehow have to include some exponential, no? So we have to include something like, I guess here there's no n. Basically something like this, exponential of something like this. Actually. And then the cost of the algorithm is exponential in this Taylor coefficient. So then you get this result about the runtime of the algorithm. And the result is this. That we have an algorithm that outputs a function that approximates this to epsilon. And the runtime of this algorithm is 1 over epsilon times exponential in time times, well, so to the power of exponential in t. So very badly because of that bad convergence. This is the type of convergence with time that you get. So actually, this method scales very badly with time. No? But what we think is interesting about this is that for times that are like order one, so this is order one, then the runtime of the algorithm is polynomial. in 1 over epsilon, right? And why is this interesting? It's interesting because it actually improves on the kind of naive way you will typically show this, which is with the Lee Robinson bound, right? So with the Lee Robinson bound, you can of course also have an algorithm for computing expectation values of local observables, right? And basically what you do is you just compute, instead of the whole system, you compute the Lee Robinson light cone, right? So if you know about the Lee Robinson bound, basically the error that you incur when you do the Lee Robinson approximation is exponentially small in the diameter of the light cone. Okay, so this is epsilon, right? So then so if you want to simulate the Lee Robinson light cone, no, which will be something like some region of diameter L, no, if you want to do this, you have to do like basically you have to compute this exactly, no, this light cone exactly, right? And the light cone has a diameter which is this. But what is the number of particles in the light cone? The number of particles is L to the dimension of the lattice. No? So for instance, in two dimensions, I have a disk of size of diameter L, but the number of particles is like L squared, right? But the cost of computing this light cone is exponential in L squared, right? So then if I put my expression for L from the Lee Robinson error, I get something that is actually, so if this is two, for instance, this is super polynomial, 1/ε, right?
So it's more of a higher level question. Like if your result about constant time, like where you get a polynomial in 1/ε algorithm,
mm-hmm.
that seems, should I think of it as analogous to a constant depth circuit? I mean, if I try to implement a constant time evolution
mm-hmm.
using a Trotter series, I would get, I think, a constant depth circuit. So my question is, like, we don't have the analogous results for constant depth circuits, right? Like, there is not an algorithm for a constant depth circuit that outputs the expected value. There's actually not a hardness result that forbids it.
So, this is for expectation values of local observables, right? So if you look at the load of circuit, you somehow just compute the light cone of that circuit,
so
right?
So A is local.
It's local. It's like single site.
A general tensor product.
No, just local. Yeah.
Okay, but then if I evolve for constant time, you can just look at the light cone. Oh,
yeah, exactly.
Okay, so
yeah.
I'm caught up now. But
yeah, okay, yeah. Yeah, so of course, in circuits, you don't have a Lee Robinson light cone, right? So there you can do it exactly.
I see.
You just compute the light cone of the circuit, no, which is exact.
And the method fails if you have a like Z tensor N, like a huge.
Yeah, because in that case, you have to count more than connected clusters. You have to count a lot of, it's not just the connected ones, no, because your operator is somehow connecting clusters that are very far away. So this basically in your expansion you have to consider all the clusters, not just the connected ones. So this method fails. Yeah.
Wait, so can the big operator undergo phase transition in time?
And I guess, yeah. I mean, if you look, for instance, the big operator could be like a string of ones and zeros, right? So this is like a sampling problem. I mean, like the big operator, I think yes, no, because.
I think it's questionable whether or not it's like a sampling problem. I mean, I remember the same thing, but like sampling for
quantum
depth circuits is very well established to be hard, at least
okay. In
an exact setting where you try to exactly sample. Whereas computing the expected value of Z tensor N up to some additive error.
This is not. Okay. Okay, so maybe I shouldn't say that. So are the phase transitions in like non-local observables, right? I guess this doesn't tell you that there aren't. That's what I can say. Because this doesn't tell you anything about that, basically. So I don't know. Yeah.
I see.
That's a good question, yeah. In any case, what I'm saying here is that if you consider like local observable, single site, and then you want to compute the Lee Robinson light cone, you end up with an algorithm which is super polynomial. For very short times, for like times order one, it's super polynomial in 1/ε. However, our algorithm is polynomial in 1/ε for like short times, of course. No? And then the convergence with time is a bit bad, no? However, actually, I want to say this, I guess I didn't write this here. So we think also this is more or less tight. And to make it better, you probably have to introduce more assumptions in the Hamiltonian. And the reason for this actually is that this in an assumption of the cluster expansion, I basically focus on Hamiltonians that are not necessarily on lattice, but it's just that every single term is connected to a few other terms. So this includes something called expander graphs also, which are basically they don't live in a lattice, no? They're like very somehow complicated Hamiltonians that are still local, no? And for this, actually, the Lee Robinson light cone, I believe, is something like, will give you something like this behavior also. So that's why we believe this is actually tight, this result, because it applies to very general local Hamiltonians, right? Okay. Any questions about this? I just want to move to the last conclusion, which is actually a little chart that we have about the complexity of dynamics, because I believe we show that we show these few things that are in blue. No, basically we show that the problem of computing these three quantities, and this I haven't talked about, but this is just follows from considerations about this. No, because this is so this is an additive error for this. This is so this is actually easier than this. So we have a problem, a computational problem, which is computing these quantities to a small additive error, and where epsilon 1 is 1 over poly n. Okay. So basically, what we show is that all these problems are in P from the previous results. Okay. And in particular, this one here, and this one here, is not is something that was not known before, no? Because if you use the Lee-Robinson bounds, you don't get this result. No? You really have to go through this cluster expansion or something like this. And the nice thing is actually is that these things are, I mean, the hardness of this problem is maybe a bit understood somehow, no? Because of course, if you look at expectation values of local observables for times that are polynomial in system size, just by very standard considerations, this problem is BQP complete. So this is somehow the hardest thing that quantum computers can do in polynomial time, no? This type of problem for like times that are like polynomial in system size, no? And also from some other computer science results, about the complexity of Ising models and so on, we know that the problem of computing this to a small additive error becomes sharply hard very quickly. So we have a radius of convergence, and if you want to go slightly beyond this to some constant time, actually, the problem already becomes sharply hard. So this thing here is shown in a bunch of papers, including this one, actually. And then these things just follow from this. So this is somehow like some consequences of our results for like complexity of dynamics, I guess. Okay, and I guess with this, I just want to finish. No, that basically I've talked about cluster expansions, no, quite a bit. They're basically just very fancy Taylor expansions, no, for this type of quantities that are functions of local Hamiltonians, no, and they work for many different interaction graphs. And here, basically, we've used them for quantum dynamics, no, for these results that I was explaining, no, and this has a bunch of different implications, no. And I guess one message I would like to convey is that I mean I think this method is, you know. This method seems to be quite flexible, no? Because here I've talked about dynamics, but it seems that you can apply it to like a bunch of different things, no? So there's maybe some room for exploring this, and for instance, for exploring the question, the more general question of like how, in which regimes are quantum systems like classically simulable, no? Or quantum computations, in which regimes are classically simulable, no? So maybe there are some models of circuits that you can simulate with this type of method, no? And this is actually something I'm kind of trying to start to explore, no? In the future, no? And yeah, with this, I would like to thank you for listening, and yeah, that's...
Yeah, that was a really great talk. So I should try to connect the imaginary to real time in some mm-hmm. different ways. So, like, naively, if I think of like two Gibbs states that are smoothly connected without phase transition, mm-hmm. then I would like to think there's some like finite depth quantum channel that mm-hmm. turns one into the other.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm wondering if like if you have like analyticity, the high temperature expansion, like some
I see.
High temperature phase that's smoothly connected. Can you prove that there's some real time dynamics like coupling with the bath and lower bath temperature that connects them in finite time?
Oh, I see. Okay, that's interesting.
Because, you know, like, ideally we want something like a ground state phase diagram being connected by a finite depth circuit if they're in the same
mm-hmm.
phase. Right? And so then you, there we have the gap gives you, the gap Hamiltonian gives you control. Right?
So you would like to know, for instance, if, so you have, okay, let me see if I understood. So you have some...
Say two different temperatures.
Yeah, so okay, so you have some E is beta 1 H1. And then you want to know whether this is like similar to something like I don't know so something like this, no? H I don't know H two t, and then here another beta H three, something like this, maybe. No, so, yeah, it has to be something like this. No?
Well,
or no?
What was the? Gibbs states cannot be unitary, right?
It cannot be unitary.
Have to change the entropy, right? So it's going to be.
Of course, yeah, of course.
Be some channel, so mm-hmm. it won't be as simple as. You know, time evolution.
Yeah. Hmm. Okay. So you put something here.
Somehow you can write it.
I guess. Yeah. I guess maybe. Point. don't know if you can come up with like some model of a channel that you can expand in this sense, no? And then maybe somehow map every term from this expansion to this expansion.
Mm-hmm.
That could seem like could work, but I don't know exactly what kind of channel you need.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's interesting, but. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because I guess, I mean, even if you think of like depolarizing noise, for instance, no, it drives you to like higher temperatures, right? So that's already maybe an example, no? Maybe this is depolarizing noise, maybe. Yeah. Drives you to high temperature, no? I don't know. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. So could we just, sorry, Doug, could we go back to that table that you had?
Yeah.
Okay. So again, I'm going to kind of just like assume that, you know, there's some kind of similarity between short time Hamiltonian dynamics, like constant time, and maybe you should be able to prove the same things in both worlds.
Mm-hmm.
So if we take that as given, like the let's consider the problem of computing the expected value of like a weight n Pauli, like z tensor.
Mm-hmm.
In the constant depth circuit world, you can conjugate each of the zi's, and that becomes now a gate of constant size, and then the whole circuit, the expected value becomes the amplitude of another constant depth circuit with gates of size proportional to the light cone size.
Okay.
So that's a reduction from the top layer to the second layer when A has weight n. Do you know what I mean? So when A has weight n in the circuit set,
right,
you can reduce from that upper
layer
to the second one that you have.
I see. I guess that's kind of what you do in the paper, in this paper, maybe.
Yeah,
no? Yeah. Yeah.
You know, an expected value of a weight n Pauli
mm-hmm.
is equivalent to an amplitude of another constant depth circuit.
Mm-hmm.
And so you tell me you can compute amplitude.
Mm-hmm.
You can't compute expected values of weight n Paulis, but you know, then I would ask, well, maybe you can, like, or
okay, so maybe you can, right? But then you have to expand around something, right? So this is like in your paper, for instance, in the Strobel, you expand around the parameter,
yeah,
right?
You have polynomials and you have other functions, but
right.
I feel that there should be some reduction between the.
Because what do you expand around? If you have Pauli sets and then you do a short depth circuit.
Yeah, so you know, you want to compute the expected value of some Pauli.
Mm. So what I know how to do, because just from reading your paper, is you will know, for instance, if you have identity plus epsilon Pauli in each site,
mm-hmm.
then you can expand around epsilon and you can compute that.
That's right. That's
with the expansion in epsilon, right?
Yes.
But if you just have the Paulis.
Well, so this can be used to compute. No, but okay. Like the point is that there's a reduction between the two. Like
if you
can compute the expected value of a unitary that is a constant depth circuit,
mm-hmm.
or e to the ith for constant time, in the zero state.
Right.
Then it seems like you should be able to use that to compute the expected value of a Pauli in a constant depth. Anyways, maybe we can talk about
that. Yeah, I think I'm following you, but I need to think about that. Maybe see it written down, what you're saying. Yeah.
I have a question that may not be directly related. So can you do perturbation theory calculation for entanglement Hamiltonian where the output of the state is a stabilizer?
So you look at some pure stabilizer state, and you look at the reduced in some reduced state in some region, right? Right. Well, I guess presumably these entanglement Hamiltonians are they're meant to be local, no? In some sense, no? So in that case, I guess you will be able to do it. But I don't know exactly how do you get the Hamiltonian from the stabilizers? You know that?
For stabilizers, it's relatively simple.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, if you have e to the minus beta h, you can do something for sure with this type of expansion. Right? So, and maybe if it comes from like a stabilizer state, maybe it's simple for other reasons, and you can use that simplicity to in your favor, not for the convergence. So, yeah.
I also got a question. about this thermal state in the high temperature expansion. So if I understand correctly, that means that even though the thermal state has no transition, okay, but then you still have some finite beta star. It's like order one, right? And in this high temperature regime, you can send efficiency, they converge, all the single properties. So conceptually, how I understand this, should I mean that, does that mean that there's some capacity transition in these thermal states? That doesn't show up for the physical operators.
Yeah, good question. That's the question of whether you can connect like a physical phase transition to a complexity phase transition, right?
That's right, yeah.
So I guess intuitively I would like to say yes, but I don't think this is known actually. I think for IC models, there are these results that are like, I don't know exactly what the status of this, but I think for classical like IC models, this is better understood. That's kind of an open question actually, and a very interesting one, I think.
Yeah. I just wonder, is there any like a nonlinear observable or other some way that I can detect a transition in this capacity?
Right.
Yeah, that would be very cool.
Okay. Well, presumably a phase transition you see in some like local order parameter, right? At the computational one, maybe you see it at the level of the logarithm of the partition function, right? So could be that they're a bit different, but it could be that they're not. So I don't know. Actually. I mean, I can tell you this is for sure an open question. So,
right.
Very interesting. Yeah. Thanks for the question.
Okay. Well, let's thank Alvaro again for a really nice talk.
Yeah, thanks.